Nearly 17,000 potential Wisconsin voters were deterred by the state's strict voter ID law in last year's presidential election. That's the findings of a new study by UW-Madison political scientists. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The researchers mailed the survey to non-voters in two counties, Dane and Milwaukee. That's where we'll begin this discussion with Barry Burden. He's a political science professor at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center and the Lyons Family Chair in Electoral Politics. Barry, welcome to The Morning Show.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Well, this study is called Estimating the Effect of Voter ID on Non-Voters in Wisconsin in the 2016 Presidential Election. What was the goal here?
Well, I think the main goal was to try to estimate how many voters in Wisconsin who are registered and eligible did not vote in 2016 because of the ID law being in place.
And so what did it find?
Well, the study is focused on two counties, Milwaukee and Dane, as you mentioned, which are the two most populous counties, and counties where the ID impact is probably greatest, given the mobility of the populations in those counties, the fact that they're younger, some lower income and minority populations. But in those counties, they found that, depending on your definition, somewhere between 6% and 11% of registered voters didn't vote in 2016 because they were either prevented from or deterred from voting because of the ID law.
So this was a voluntary survey sent to non-voters in the mail. What was your turnout like in getting these surveys back?
Well, as you can imagine, this is a really challenging sort of study to do, to estimate the effect of something that didn't happen. These are people who didn't vote. And so the researchers decided to do a mail survey of registered voters. It was 2,400 voters in the two counties. Only about 12% of those people returned the surveys. That's in part because some people had moved away, had died, or otherwise were not available, couldn't be found via the mail. And then of those 12%, they were asked, did you vote in the election? If not, what was the main reason? What forms of ID do you possess? And then putting together the answers to those questions is where we get the between 6 and 11% of the population being affected.
Well, 293 surveys that are returned to you, how can you extrapolate from that? Is that really enough to draw legitimate estimates?
The sample size is enough. 293 is plenty, and there are some statistical corrections that are done to report the amount of uncertainty. In fact, the what are called the confidence intervals, or the range of plus or minus factor that you might expect, is included there. The bigger worry is that those 293 people are unrepresentative in some way, that the kinds of people who responded to the survey are just different. Maybe they're more likely to have ID, less likely to have ID, more likely, less likely to be interested in politics. That's the kind of concern we can't quite do away with. But the sample size itself is not such a problem.
So what were some of the biggest concerns that people said on the survey for why they didn't turn out in the 2016 presidential election to vote?
Well, voter ID was not the number one reason. It was also not the number two or number three reason. It was pretty far down the list. Most people said they didn't vote because they didn't like the candidates. They weren't interested in the issues. They didn't have time. They didn't think their vote mattered. Maybe they had transportation problems or other logistical issues. And that's consistent with what we see in other national surveys like this that ask even more representative populations, national populations, why they didn't vote. It tends to be just dislike of the process or lack of interest in the candidates. And that shows up here as well. But at the bottom of the list, usually the last item or next to last item, is either I didn't vote because I lacked ID, or I went to vote and I was told I didn't have the right ID. So it's a small number, but again, multiplied times the number of people affected in these two counties, and if we go beyond that to think about what it might be statewide, it is in the thousands of people who would have been either deterred or prevented from voting because of ID.
Well, there's been some pushback, a rebuttal to the study by Rick Essenberg and Will Flanders. Part of their argument is that the study has little bearing on the results of the 2016 presidential election. Do you see this as having a little bearing on what happened?
Well, you know, the authors of the study didn't think that their purpose was to show that the ID law affected the outcome of the election. They didn't ask people in the survey how they voted. We don't know that. The study was funded by the Dane County Clerk, and so it's inappropriate, in fact, for an election official to know how people voted or to begin asking those kinds of questions. I think the larger question is a set of legal ones about what kind of burden and what kind of requirements we can ask of voters that are reasonable given the Voting Rights Act and the Constitution, and whether the voter ID law is unnecessarily burdensome. Looks like it was some thousands of people who were affected. That's not a trivial number. It might have been enough to change the outcome of the election. It's certainly in that range.
Well, it seems like there's a gray area. Is there a gray area here?
There certainly is. Yeah, there is. The presidential election was decided by about 22,000 votes in such a close contest. Anything could have mattered, from the weather to certainly the conduct of the campaigns themselves to the issues that were on the table, those kinds of things.
Talking right now with Barry Burden. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison, directs the Elections Research Center and the Lyons Family Chair in Electoral Politics. You can join this discussion, 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the results of this UW-Madison survey, or do you have questions about the survey? Do you think voter ID laws are a good idea? Do you think they're too strict? Do you support certain regulations for identification at the polls, even if that means some people don't vote? Join in, 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. That's WPR Mornings. Barry, what needs to happen from this survey? Was the survey a good idea? What does it give us insight for the future?
Well, I think it was a good idea. There are just so many people in the state, in fact, around the country, who are interested in what effect the ID requirement had on voters in 2016. People have been clamoring for evidence like this. It's an imperfect study, but I think it's such an important issue that it needed to be done. I think one of the interesting results from the study that can inform what the state does going forward is the amount of confusion that respondents in the survey had about the ID law. There are actually a significant number of people who said they didn't vote in 2016 because of the ID requirement, but then in a separate part of the survey said that they had the kinds of ID that would make them eligible to vote. So they apparently were not aware that they actually possessed the ID that would have allowed them to vote. And so just the lack of information or the misinformation that people have could be addressed through more public education.
We had a caller who couldn't stay with us who wants to ask, how did you get such results when there were no follow-up questions?
I'm not sure what's meant by follow-up questions. It was just a one-time mail survey. Again, sent to about 2,400 people who were registered, and so they're in the state voter registration database, but didn't vote in 2016.
It begs the question that, you know, there are so many different scenarios as to why someone might not turn out to vote. As you mentioned, could be the weather, could be voter ID laws, could be the candidates on the ballot.
It could be, and so I think the researchers were careful to try to use questions that had been vetted through other surveys. And in fact, the main question here, which is about why you didn't vote, has been asked in government surveys going back to the 1960s, which asked people after each election if they weren't registered or if they didn't vote, why that didn't happen. And I think the pattern of responses in this survey is similar to the pattern we see in those other national surveys, which is some reassurance that really the top reasons for most people are that they just didn't like the candidates, weren't attracted to what was going on in the race.
Didn't think
their vote was going to have an effect.
Yeah, let's try to fit in a caller here quickly. Mac in Eau Claire. Go ahead, Mac.
Hi. During the election, I helped a couple of my friends vote. And because of the way the voter ID laws were written, our campus ID wasn't valid, and we had to get a separate form. We had to get a separate voter ID just to vote, even though the university has all of our information, like our residency information and whatnot. And I know that if a friend that I tried to help vote, if they didn't have their their driver's license and a proof of residency on them. When they went to class that morning on election day, they had to trek all the way back up the hill at UW-Eau Claire to get that. And I just think it's an unnecessary burden.
Thank you, Mac. Barry, jump in very quickly as we wrap up.
Yeah, we suspect that students are some of the population that are affected by the ID law most acutely, in part because student IDs often don't work under the law, but also because many don't have driver's licenses or they're moving and simply have to get an ID that will let them vote in Wisconsin.
Well, Barry, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
Barry Burden is a political scientist at UW-Madison and directs the Elections Research Center and the Lyons Family Chair in Electoral Politics. We've been discussing a new study of non-voters in Wisconsin that found nearly 17,000 were deterred from voting in the last presidential election. We'll be back after these news headlines. It's a State Capitol Report on the morning show. Good morning, I'm Kate Archer Kent. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments this week on redistricting, and Wisconsin will be front and center. The plaintiffs in the case claim that the boundaries of Wisconsin State Assembly districts are gerrymandered to favor Republican candidates. Malia Jones is here to break down the argument and to explain what is at the heart of the issue. She's a social epidemiologist with the Applied Population Laboratory at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She researches how community and space affect health at the population level. Malia, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, analysts are calling the Wisconsin case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court a potentially landmark decision. What questions does the Gill versus Whitford case raise?
The core question in the case is really about whether the redistricting process that took place after the 2010 census unfairly favors Republicans in the state assembly.
And so how will this go before the Supreme Court? What will happen first in the Supreme Court this week?
So the Supreme Court is going to hear oral arguments that will. So the plaintiffs argue that the Republican majority in 2011, when they created the new district boundaries, used gerrymandering tactics in order to divide Democratic voters across too many districts and favor Republicans. So I'm not a Supreme Court expert, so I don't know exactly what the proceedings are going to look like in the Supreme Court, but I know we're all going to be watching closely to see what happens here. This case has been heard in the Wisconsin courts and also in a federal court who agreed that this was a partisan gerrymander. And so the Supreme Court's going to be reviewing the evidence.
Define for us, what is a gerrymander?
So gerrymandering is the process, it's when the district boundaries in some kind of legislative geography, in this case, it's the state assembly districts, that's the lower house of the Wisconsin state legislature. Those boundaries are purposefully drawn to favor or to disfavor one group over another. And typically in the past, the Supreme Court has ruled many times on racial gerrymandering, which is where a racial majority has created district boundaries purposely to strip power from racial minorities. And in this case is really unique and it's getting a lot of attention because the Supreme Court is going to rule or is going to hear arguments about a partisan gerrymander. So in this case, the argument is that the Republican Party, who was in control at the time of the districting, purposely created these boundaries to strip power from Democrats.
So going back to this 2010 census and the redrawing that occurs, how radically different was the redrawing? What can we see from it?
So it was pretty different. The process of redistricting is a regular occurrence. It happens every 10 years following the decennial census. And this is necessary because of demographic change. And the authors of the state constitution and the federal constitution recognize this. When they were setting up our representative democracy, they recognized that populations change, and in general, cities in the United States have been growing. And so as the population grows in one place, we need to create new district boundaries in order to maintain equal representation, or the basically the idea that one of our representatives has about the same number of constituents as any other of our representatives. So this process happens every 10 years after the decennial census. And the redistricting that occurred in right after the 2010 census was pretty different from the district boundaries that were before.
What made it so different?
Well, as this case has argued before a couple of courts and will argue before the Supreme Court, it really favors Republican candidates in the state assembly. And so what we see is boundaries that that are purported to either crack or pack. We have these two processes in gerrymandering called cracking and packing. And cracking refers to a practice of, we have a concentration of Democratic voters, usually in urban places. And cracking refers to creating a district boundary that has a majority of Republican voters, but sort of scoops up a little bit of a concentration of Democrats. And so those Democrats are divided across several majority Republican districts.
So kind of diluting.
Yeah, it's diluting. Exactly.
Okay.
And then packing is sort of the converse process, where a district is drawn so that as many opposition party voters are packed into one district as possible, really guaranteeing that that district will go to the opposition party, but preserving neighboring districts from being really competitive.
So are the lines filled with this cracking and packing? I mean, can you see it?
So it turns out it's quite hard to measure. And one of the issues before the Supreme Court is, how do we figure out whether this really is happening? Partisan gerrymandering and accusations of partisan gerrymandering are not at all new. In fact, the term gerrymandering was coined in a case where that was a partisan gerrymander. It happens because the leading party at the time of redistricting is really in control of how those boundaries are drawn, and it is a regular occurrence. So there's lots of opportunity here. Your question was, can we see this cracking and packing? And what the Supreme Court is going to hear this week is an argument for something called the efficiency gap, which is a way of measuring whether we do see cracking and packing going on, and whether it's more than we would expect just from sort of random occurrence or other concurrent demographic processes.
So we can kind of put a formula over this,
yeah,
and you know, ferret out whether this is going on.
Right. Yeah, it's sort of a test for whether or not what we're seeing in the maps really is gerrymandering. And the previous courts have upheld the plaintiff's argument that this was a partisan gerrymander. And so in the Supreme Court, we'll hear about this efficiency gap, which is the measure, and whether or not the Supreme Court will accept that as a metric of partisan gerrymandering.
Malia Jones is with us. She's a social epidemiologist with the Applied Population Laboratory at UW-Madison. She researches how community and space affect health at the population level. You can join in this discussion as the U.S. Supreme Court this week takes up Wisconsin's gerrymandering case. Do you think Wisconsin's redistricting decisions are unconstitutional? What is the fair way to redraw voting districts as populations shift, as people in power shift? 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@WPR. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at WPR Mornings. That's WPR Mornings. Malia, gerrymandering is a word, as you've mentioned, to describe voting boundaries, to steer a vote in a certain direction. Is gerrymandering ever good?
So in the past, the Supreme Court has ruled that it is constitutional to create what's called a majority-minority electoral district in order to enhance the power of especially a racial or ethnic minority. And in a case like that, it has been argued that gerrymandering is legal and appropriate because you're trying to give a representative voice to a minority that would otherwise never have enough population concentration to get that representation. So in some cases, I mean, these are very blurry boundaries. It's a really hard thing to rule on whether an electoral map has been gerrymandered and whether that is really detrimental to the electorate.
One argument is that people live alongside neighbors with similar views, so this voter segregation happens naturally. It's an organic process. What's your perspective on that notion?
Yeah, we actually just talked about this in a piece on WisContext because the Republican National Committee submitted a brief to the Supreme Court where they made that exact argument, that this is a natural demographic process. Democrats are more and more concentrated in urban places. And so the packing that we see is really just natural demographic change. I think that argument is not quite right because it is true that Democrats increasingly are concentrated in cities, and that's true in Wisconsin as it is in most other places. But what we see in the electoral maps is that, for example, the city of Milwaukee or the county of Milwaukee contains quite a few districts. And so there's plenty of opportunity to draw district boundaries within an urban place. And we do see some evidence of packing even within the boundaries of a city. So to say that this is really just an urban-rural issue, I think is an oversimplification of what's going on.
Let's take a call now. Darren in Green Bay. Go ahead, Darren.
Yeah, hi. I had a quick question, I guess, in regards to how these lines are set up. Why is it that we don't have a separate nonpartisan entity like we do for, like, you know, the CBO that decides the the healthcare costs instead of for doing these districts, instead of, say, like, you know, when the census goes through, if there's a Republican Party that happens to be in power in this case, you know, they're obviously the ones that are going to, you know, redraw the maps, or Democrats later on, you know, depending on how it would be. Why is it not, I guess, nonpartisan, a separate entity that draws these lines?
Darren, thanks for your call. Malia?
I think that is a great question, and it's one of the questions that's on the table in this court case. Several states do have a nonpartisan or a bipartisan commission, or the courts draw their district maps or are involved in drawing their district maps. And one of the outcomes of this case has been, of this case going before the Supreme Court, has been increased advocacy for a nonpartisan or bipartisan approach, or even a data-grounded approach to gerrymandering. So upcoming next week at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, there's going to be this workshop called Geometry of Gerrymandering that looks at mathematical approaches to drawing these maps that would be based in the data instead of controlled by the legislature.
But is data the only fix here? I mean, can data really make it fair?
Probably not 100%. I think it would help to remove the partisanship from the process if we based it in sort of mathematical algorithms and data science instead, but it's not going to be possible to do that 100%. And as I just said, there are some cases where we want to purposely concentrate a voice that wouldn't otherwise have representation. So it is tricky, and I agree that that one good way forward might be to have a nonpartisan or a bipartisan approach to drawing the maps.
Darren, thanks for your call. Let's go to Nate now in Milwaukee. Go ahead, Nate.
Hi, thank you. I would say that gerrymandering definitely has a big impact on our state. I think it also violates the 14th Amendment to the Constitution because it effectively deprives people of their vote when it comes to the state legislature, and that their vote doesn't matter anymore. Here in not too far away in Leah Volkmir's district, I would say that's an excellent way to see where gerrymandering happened, because that state senate district used to flip back and forth between parties depending on how the voters felt. And now it's very strongly Republican. Two of the three state assembly districts in it used to be very competitive, and until these new maps were very close, were held by Democrats in very close elections, and now all three are Republican. So I would say I can look there and see where a swing district no longer responds to changes in the mood of the electorate like it used to.
Malia, are there some areas, too, in not in the cities that you can see this happening that are not flipping back and forth based on the views of the voter?
Yeah, certainly you can see a stronger Republican presence and less competitive districts across the state in many places. And it is not just something that's happening in cities. In fact, I'd say it's more likely to happen outside of the cities. Cities are very concentrated Democrat strongholds. And so they really do almost always go for Democratic candidates. And it's those suburban and more sort of middle of the ground urban rural places that historically did flip back and forth. And now in the past few elections, you've seen them very strongly favor Republicans. And one more comment there, I would just add that Nate was talking about the state Senate districts. That's the upper house of the Wisconsin legislature, which is not directly challenged. Those maps are not directly challenged in this Supreme Court case. But the way Wisconsin creates the Senate districts is their three assembly district boundaries added together. Mm. And so they are implicitly involved with this case as well, although they're not directly being challenged.
So to get philosophical here, what is the point of redistricting?
So the point of redistricting is really the rock of representative democracy, which is this idea of one vote, one person, one vote, or equal representation. So the point of it is to create equal representation so that each citizen has a representative voice in the state legislature that's about equal to each other person.
And we've been hearing about these throwaway votes in the gerrymandered districts. Are there throwaway votes out there in Wisconsin?
So this is a controversial terminology for something that's going on in the Supreme Court case. People do not like the idea of votes being thrown away. The efficiency gap measures what they call wasted votes. And I think it's a little unfortunate that that's what they call it. But the idea is that every vote cast that is for a losing candidate is wasted, right? That person didn't get what they wanted. Also, every vote cast for the winning candidate in excess of the number needed to win is also wasted. You didn't need that vote in order to win. And so the efficiency gap measures the difference between the number of votes that are cast for each party statewide versus the proportion of representation in the outcome. And so we have a state assembly that is heavily Republican leaning, when if you add up all the votes statewide, we actually have much closer to a 50-50 divide in terms of Republicans and Democrats. And so the argument is that all those votes in between, all those in this case Democrats who voted for Democratic candidates but did not get Democratic representation, are quote-unquote wasted.
Well, Malia, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be watching this week.
Yeah, we all will. Thank you.
Malia Jones is a social epidemiologist with the Applied Population Laboratory at UW-Madison. She joined us to explain the Wisconsin gerrymandering lawsuit before the U.S. Supreme Court. And we'll have continuing coverage of the proceedings with WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, who is on the ground there covering this case in Washington. He'll join us tomorrow and Wednesday at 7. After the news, we'll be back with Representative Gordon Hintz. You're listening to the State Capitol Report on this first Monday of October. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the state assembly, the Senate Democratic leadership job has been a revolving door of sorts. Democrats have had six leaders over the past decade. Joining us now is the newly elected minority leader of the Wisconsin Assembly. Democrat Gordon Hintz represents Oshkosh. He took over leadership from Representative Peter Barca last month. Representative Hintz, welcome to the show.
Hey, happy to be here.
Well, we just talked about redistricting as the U.S. Supreme Court considers whether Wisconsin draws boundaries legally. What's your take on redistricting?
Well, my take on redistricting is I think most people would believe that we should have voters choose their politics, their officials, not the other way around. Wisconsin is on the big stage because of what Republicans in the legislature and Governor Walker did when they created the maps that they did that have created such that have gone so far in giving partisan advantage that, violated a standard that one court has already ruled is unconstitutional. And I think there's a good chance the Supreme Court will agree.
Well, drawing borders that benefit a majority party makes it harder for you in the minority to win seats in the state house. But this could also be flipped. Should politicians be in control of these mapping these districts?
Well, I think the problem in Wisconsin is we've had divided government. So, when past redistricting has been done, you've either had Republicans in charge of one house or in charge of the governorship, and it's been split. So you've had maps that have had to be ironed out between both sides. This is really the first time in recent memory that we've seen this. And, of course, it's become so sophisticated that you can pretty much, pick your voters with some certainty depending on how you divide up things. And it's not the way it should be done. We need to pass maps that are fit the existing borders of things that are on some objective criteria other than just pure partisan advantage.
We were also talking about a survey, a recent survey of non-voters in the presidential election and looking at voter ID laws and strict voter ID laws, whether that impacted the outcome and the people who turned up at the polls. Do you see an issue with Wisconsin's voter ID laws?
I mean, absolutely. At the time, and I think most people understand that this legislation was never intended to prevent any kind of voter fraud because it can't, right? Unless you have a fake ID, it was mostly meant to suppress voters that Republicans don't want so they can, again, shape future elections. I mean, whether it is redistricting or voter ID, so many of the decisions made over the last 6 years have been made for partisan advantage, not to benefit people in Wisconsin. I was not surprised to see that, we knew that it certainly suppressed the vote. Anytime that you create a barrier to vote, whether it's the confusion over whether they have the ID or not, or which ID is valid, or even someone having to go get an ID, that's an additional burden on a person that doesn't exist for somebody else. And we've had those arguments made over time. We've had courts rule against this. I know it's gone back and forth, but, at the end of the day, it appears that the intent of the law worked, in the favor of Republicans and that, tens of thousands of people were discouraged from voting.
Well, Representative Hintz, here you are, the new minority leader in the state assembly. Why are you the right person for this role?
Well, we're trying to put ourselves in the best position to be successful going into the 2018 election. I'm stepping up to be leader because I want to unite our caucus and spread the Democratic message around the state. We're a big, diverse party. We've got a strong set of core beliefs and values, and I think, trying to translate those values behind policies that'll, contrast with what's happened over the last 6 years is really the challenge. Before us, it's been a tough time for Democrats, not just in Wisconsin, but around the country. But we've got some really motivated members. I think the challenge for us is reaching some voters that maybe we've lost over the last few years, not just contrasting or not just, criticizing some of the policies of the last 6 years, but offering something that will make people's lives ultimately better.
Do you see any division at all between the younger Democrats in office and the older regime, if you will, to say it as a regime, but the older Democrats who have been in office?
I don't think so. I mean, we have, again, a lot of different people who provide a variety of life experiences that they bring to office, but we're all kind of united around the values of fairness, opportunity, community. And while I mentioned that we bring, you know, diverse backgrounds to office, we're really united around those things. And I think it's those core values that our policies stem from, and they'll be successful in reaching voters around the state.
Talking right now with Representative Gordon Hintz, the new minority leader in the Wisconsin State Assembly. You can join in this discussion, 800-642-1234. What priorities should Democrats in the State Assembly have? How do you think the minority can be effective in setting the agenda for Wisconsin? Join in, 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Representative Hintz, some fellow Democrats spoke out about Peter Barker's departure. He resigned after voting in favor of the Foxconn bill, which benefits his part of Wisconsin. Are Assembly Democrats tolerating less moderation and leaning further left, do you think?
I don't think this has anything to do, really, with Peter or the vote that he took on Foxconn. I think really it was about looking forward and demonstrating shared values and contrasting with the Republican Party that's never been more unpopular than it is now. I think the Foxconn vote for most Democrats around the state, those running for governor, those in the Senate and the Assembly, sort of is a microcosm of the decisions that have been made by Governor Walker and the Republicans the last few years, where their biggest priority seems to be giving away tax money to some of the wealthiest individuals in the state of Wisconsin with little accountability and at the expense of programs that benefit all Wisconsinites and are usually a better value, such as public education and our UW system, infrastructure, and supporting small business development. Those are all things that will come at the expense of this. And so, we think that Foxconn is too risky, too unaccountable, and too expensive.
Well, when you were elected to lead, Republicans released a statement that Wisconsin families can't trust you, that you disrespect women. How do you respond to what they said about you?
Well, I'd say this, if this is all the Republicans have to say, they're going to have to come up with some better talking points and a better agenda. Look, I've, apologized for past mistakes, but I'm not going to apologize for the work I've done, over the last 6 years on behalf of working families across the state and my district in Oshkosh.
So what will the legislative priorities be then?
Well, again, we've highlighted many of the things. I mean, Democrats believe in investing in infrastructure, not just borrowing and delaying things. I mean, so a good transportation network for safety, for efficiency, to help support our economy is something that we believe in. That's in stark contrast to a governor who's continued to punt and put things on the credit card. We believe in that, if you're going to provide opportunity and economic opportunity around the state, you've got to invest in public education and the UW system, not just in 1 year before an election, but over time. We believe that we need to address the more than 1 million individuals in Wisconsin with student loan debt that's, having a negative impact on the economy and on people being able to make investments in other things. Democrats believe in a DNR that is based on sound science that protects our natural resources and environment. We believe that small business growth is where the future of most jobs are going to be created. And again, we know that. And we know that Wisconsin is dead last when it comes to startups. But we need to have economic policies that are rural, urban, north, south, east, west, throughout Wisconsin. And I think focusing on investments like rural broadband development, where Wisconsin is way behind, is something that Democrats are making a much higher priority than the current administration and majority.
Let's take a call now at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jeff in Medford. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I had a question on the voter ID discussion we had earlier. I don't understand, from anyone's perspective, how anyone in this world, at least in this country, is not, at least unless it's a small percentage, is not able to get an ID, because almost everything we have to do today requires an ID. So I guess I'm not sure how that is in any way suppressing anybody from voting. I mean, if I don't have enough energy to go get an ID, why would I care about politics? So I just wanted to say that, and also that I'm really disappointed in NPR because you guys just spent so much time bashing one side and supporting the other, and I thought a public radio is more balanced.
All right. Well, Jeff, thanks for calling in. Representative Hintz, I'm going to have you respond here.
Well, I'll say this. I mean, whether it's a small percentage or a bigger percentage, any time that you're making it more difficult for some people to vote, you're suppressing the vote. To say it's not a big deal for someone who may not have a car, who may not have an ID, to take time off of work, to try to find a ride, to try to secure public transportation, to be able to obtain an ID for the purposes of voting, and an ID that's not going to do anything to prevent, voter fraud, is exactly the problem with, the voter ID laws, is that it makes it difficult. It creates an obstacle. It creates an obstacle of inconvenience. And so we're not talking about renting a movie. We're not talking about going to the YMCA where you have a reason to have an ID. We're talking about the right to vote. And that's something that, American citizens are granted in this state.
Well, as we begin to wrap up here, do you see opportunities to work across the aisle with your fellow Republicans, and where?
Always. I think that's got to be our first priority as elected individuals from our district, is to just try to work to get some of the best things done that will address the challenges of our state. And to the extent that we can find those opportunities with Republicans, that's what we need to do. It's always work together when you can, fight and disagree when there's policies that don't support the best interests of Wisconsinites, and try to hold them accountable. I think we have a lot of members who have found they've been able to work on those relationships, especially in some areas of natural resources. I think Representative Clefish and Representative Milroy have a good bipartisan working relationship. And I look forward to sitting down with the speaker. I think looking at the Milwaukee metro area, which, has Republicans and Democrats, and looking at what things that we can do to try to address the labor shortage we have.
And I'm going to have to stop you there. Thank you so much, Representative Hintz. Gordon Hintz is Minority Leader in the Wisconsin State Assembly. He's a Democrat from Oshkosh. This hour, the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina and Niaja Ellison. Michelle Johnson is Executive Producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you'll find us on the Ideas Network.